Hello, welcome to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And this is Dr. Lana Love. Welcome to our show.
Today, we're very excited to have our special guest with us, Derek Jensen, who is an ecological poet philosopher and co-founder of Deep Green Resistance.
We are so happy for you to be on our show. We've read a lot about Deep Green Resistance. It's a huge movement. It's a beautiful movement of love and a huge attempt to save the planet. So thank you for being on our show, Derek.
Thank you for coming back on Universal Soul Love.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Derek, tell us how this all began. It's a huge movement, isn't it?
What is this? Do you mean Deep Green Resistance or my work or the mess that we find ourselves in? What when you ask, well, how did this begin, what you talking about?
Well, I guess I'm talking about your philosophy and the establishment of Deep Green Resistance. How did all of this begin? What is it about you that's so different from other people? We're all in this mess and we're not doing things. You are, and the people in Deep Green Resistance are, and I really admire that. How did you get this way? How did you get to be such an active savior of our planet?
Well, I think, and thank you for that, and I think that for me and for my work, I guess there are several threads we can talk about. And in some senses, one of the first threads really was, I'm gonna tell a few stories and then we'll hope to bring them together.
Sure.
And part of it for me began with my father's, he's dead now. My father was extremely violent and he broke my sister's arm, my brother, a couple of different blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And when I was a child, I was asking, not using this language, but the question was in the air, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And I couldn't understand why he was acting. That didn't make any sense. And so one thread began with that, with the question of why do people do things that are gratuitously destructive? Okay, there's one thread. Another thread began when I was in second grade, so that's when I was 7 or 8. There was a subdivision went in right next door to where I lived. And so all the meadowlarks were gone and the garter snakes were gone. The anthills were gone. The grasshoppers were gone. The cottonwood trees were gone. And I remember thinking, once again, I didn't have this language, but the idea was there that, well, I did have this language. It's like, so if they keep taking the homes of the meadowlarks, where are they going to go? And there was a part of me understood in, when I was very young, 7 or 8, that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I didn't have that. That's the language I didn't have yet. But I understood that in my guts. And to this day, I don't understand why more people don't understand that. It's a pretty simple concept. And so let's fast forward now to when I was in high school. I was good at math. And if you're good at math in high school, then you usually go to a science or engineering school. And I did. I didn't really like it. And a lot of my fellow students didn't really like it either. And I started to have this sort of hobby of asking people if they like their jobs. And about 90% would say no. You know, I would ask if I got on a bus, if I was just walked into a bookstore, no matter where I was, I would ask. So just if I get into a conversation with somebody, it's like, so do you like your job? And most people said no. And so I started wondering, and my fellow students, like I said, most of them didn't like school either, but they would say, well, but when I get out of here, I'm going to make a lot of money and I'm going to buy myself a nice car. And I actually had fellow students who were talking about what they were going to do when they retired. So these are 20-year-olds talking about what they're going to do when they're 60. And that's nuts. You know, that's just, you're wishing away your life. And also I knew that if I went that path, that I would work for 40 years, retire, and then the next day I would get hit by a bus. You know, it's like, it's just the way things would go. And so I started asking if what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? And I started asking, whom does this system serve? Which takes us back to that childhood question of, you know, if my father's behavior isn't making me happy, why is he doing it? Whom was the abuse actually serving? And there's a sense in which it was serving him because he achieved a compliant family. But there's another sense in which the costs were so great because he achieved a compliant family at the expense of familial love and familial relations, of truly affectionate relations. And we can see how this applies on the larger scale of, you know, the dominant culture has conquered the planet, and that brings with it a tremendous power and an ability to enslave the world, but at what costs? And, you know, I'm going to go, so there's sort of some of the background on some of the threads that led me to my questioning, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. But I'll keep going there for a second, then I'll divert. But there's an environmentalist friend of mine who says that a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. And the reason that'll happen is because they'll ask, so why is this land being destroyed? You know, if they're trying to protect a specific piece of ground, it's easy to ask, why is this happening? And usually the answer is because it makes money. And so if you start to ask, why is this land being destroyed? Then you start asking, why is any land destroyed? And then if you find out that a lot of it is destroyed to make money or to build up infrastructure or whatever, then you start asking, why would you have an economic system that's built on destroying the land that is your only home? Why would you have an economic system that is in opposition to life on the planet? That's kind of crazy. And so for me, part of the reason that I've ended up the way I am, for better or for worse, is because when I start asking these questions, I don't stop. And I don't know why that is. Actually, the real question is, I don't know why other people don't continue to ask the questions, yes, especially with exactly. All the world at stake. And so that's where some of this comes from. And I want to go back to a minute ago when I was talking about if you can establish power over others, but at what cost? I want to talk about something that Richard Dawkins said. Richard Dawkins, the famous scientific philosopher, the selfish gene. One of the things he says somewhere is he has this great line about how science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. I'll say it again. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. That's absolutely true in terms of if I flip a switch, the lights go on. So we have made matter and energy jump through hoops on command. We have predicted what will happen and when. Science is great at that. But there's something very sneaky about this, which is that he has conflated the ability to dominate with how we know that something is true. And to think of this another way, let's pretend that y'all and I are in the same room, and let's pretend that I have a hoop and I also have a gun. And I aim this gun at you and I say, on the count of three, I want you to jump through this hoop or I'm going to shoot you. On the count of three, you jump through the hoop. And what do you know? I'm a genius because I made matter and energy jump through hoops on command. And I also predict what would happen and when. But there's a problem. And the problem is, what do you think it would do to our relationship if I pointed a gun at you and said I was going to shoot you? It would probably destroy any possibility of friendship or long-term cooperative relationship. And so that for me is a great way to get at the core of part of the problem is that if you have chosen a life where your very understanding of what it means for something to be true is conflated with whether you can dominate it, then that will give you great power, and it will cost you not only your relationships with the rest of the world, but as we see, it will cost the entire world itself. Mm. And so in many ways, that's sort of some of my work.
That's amazing. What you've actually done is you've lifted the veil on the basic almost paradox of the belief systems and behaviors of our world.
And this is what we call the fundamental disconnect in human consciousness that we're going to be talking about on another radio network later.
The human mind has the ability to mix its beliefs and its understanding. We have the ability, unfortunately, to do paradoxical things, have one belief behave in a different way. We have the ability to infuse our belief systems into the whole understanding of our world. And what's really hit me when I read your website is the fact that our civilization is actually detrimental to our whole existence. Our way of thinking, our way of behaving is so fundamentally flawed, it is suicidal.
And in the meantime, we get a lot of channels of television. I'm completely agreeing with you. And part of the reason we don't resist is because we are bought off with access to ice cream 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Lewis Mumford called this the magnificent bribe. He talked about how only fairly rudimentary authoritarian systems rely only on killing anybody who disagrees. That if you really want to have an effective authoritarian system, for one thing, you have to make it, you have to get people to consent. And there's many ways to do that we can talk about. And one of the ways to get them to consent is to buy them off with luxury goods. And so that's a question that Lewis Mumford was asking 60 years ago now, was why is it that so many of us are not opposing the murder of the planet? And his answer is that we have bought into a magnificent bribe where we are given as much as we can consume, as long as we will accept as much as is given to us by the system and not demand anything that the system cannot give us. So we can have access to 175 different types of food in the grocery store, but I live just that way, maybe 50 yards is a stream that should be full of salmon, and it is almost empty of salmon. And so as long as I can go to the grocery store and buy all this crap, this processed food, it's like I am given that in exchange for this. And this happens in the colonies. I know a woman who used to be married to a guy from Bangladesh. And even 15 years ago, 20 years ago, his mother would say to him, "Can you please go down to the river and catch us some fish for lunch?" And he would do it. But then since then, the river is so polluted that it no longer has fish, and they have to buy their fish from Iceland. And that is how the system works, is that destroying the local food supplies and making it so you're dependent upon the system, and also at the same time then giving you this variety of consumables, which includes television, ice cream, everything else, but you can't. Okay, where I live right here, I don't know if people, how well people can see these trees back here, but the trees, they're redwood trees, and they have the bark on the trees is, okay, this might freak out the producer, but I'm going to walk up to the tree and then I'll come back. Can you see how the bark is really textured?
Yes.
And not just having these ridges, but also like right there, you can see where there's little torn off pieces. And that's because bears climb these trees all the time. And that's really cool, and it makes me very excited and happy. Likewise, these steps, I don't know if you can see how the steps, that's because the bears have chewed on them. Okay, that's all really cool. That's great. But prior to conquest, the people who lived in this area would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes if you lived near a river. And so I get excited when I see two bears in a day, which I usually see a mother and a baby every day. That thrills me no end. Except that is, if I were dropped in this exact spot 800 years ago, I would think it was an incredibly impoverished day if I only saw two bears. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that all of these goodies have cost us.
Mm-hmm. It's really frightening, and it's really confronting, and it just breaks through the whole illusion that we're in. So my next question is, are we a slave species? Has this been done to us? Or is this a basic issue in humanity that we're ignorant and that we allow this to happen?
Mother and I talk about this a lot lately, and I often say, you know, it's because I've worked in criminal defense investigations, and I've worked in the court system for many years, and I've studied human behavior. My experiences I have a great understanding of what you've gone through, I think, and so. I often think that we all have a responsibility, and we can't use the excuse of the devil made me do it. However, in saying that, we have been manipulated, and there's been a lot of deception, and we've had a lot of other guests on our show, like Michael Tellinger, bring this up, and others. So,
I know Michael Tellinger believes that the issue is money. Other people will argue the issue is human nature. Mm-hmm. Human nature is very diverse. We have beautiful, angelic, humanitarian people. We have vile, greedy people as well.
However,
and just the general person, including you and me, will continue to buy from Coles use consumerism despite everything that you've said. We want to change, but is it fundamental human nature, or have we been dominated by the 1%, the elitist?
I mean, do we point the finger, or do we take some responsibility?
I don't think that it is either human nature or the 1%. I think that the Talawa Indians lived here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe in science. And if you believe in the Talawa, they lived here since the beginning of time. And in either case, they lived here a long, long time. They lived here at least 12,000 years. That's long enough to count as sustainable. And I'm not saying they were perfect, but they lived here sustainably. So not every human has destroyed their land base. Mm-hmm. And Ruth Benedict, the anthropologist, did a wonderful study. She wanted to figure out why some cultures are very warlike and some are more peaceful. Some treat women and children poorly, some treat women and children well. Some are full of competition and unhappiness, and others are much more full of cooperation and happiness. And why is that? And what she found is that the difference is not race. It's not like you have people of some skin color who act one way and people of another skin color act another way. That's not the fit. It's not house size. It's not climate. It's not like people in cold weather live are mean and people in warm weather are nice, or the other way around. Instead, what she found is that people like Richard Dawkins and the Selfish Gene like to posit that humans are fundamentally selfish and that all beings fundamentally exploit each other. And then you get other people who say that we are fundamentally cooperative and social, and that the fundamental unit of evolution is the fundamental motor of evolution is cooperation. I'm one of those people, by the way, that believes that evolution is primarily based on cooperation. We can talk about that or not. But the point is that I think the truth is that we're both right and we're both wrong. And that Ruth Benedict understood that. And what she understood is that humans are both selfish and altruistic. No, I'm sorry. We are both selfish and social. And the good cultures realize that. And it's all really simple. Okay, I'm gonna stop there, and I'm gonna go a different direction for a second. And John Livingston, you see why my books are written in a nonlinear fashion, because that's just how I think. So John Livingston wrote a book called Rogue Primate. He's great. I love his work. And he thinks that the problem is when we substituted ideology for instinct. And I really disagreed with that when I read it. But the more I think about it, the more I like it, because ideology is not reliable. And what I mean by that is you can make an ideology that is really, really, really nasty and counter and contrary to survival, as we see. And here's how it works. The Ruth Benedict found that humans, as I said, are both selfish and social. And the good cultures figured out, and this is just so basic, I can't believe that we all don't get this, but the good cultures figured out that what you reward is the behavior you get. Duh. And so if you want to have a society, the good cultures figured out that what you do is you socially reward behavior that benefits the group as a whole, and you disallow behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. The bad cultures, on the other hand, reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group and disreward behavior that benefits the group. And so she found that it all came down to how they handle wealth. And what that means is if it handles wealth through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, everybody is secure and there's no reason for people to be at each other's throats. On the other hand, if you have a society that handles wealth through what they call a funnel system, whereby wealth is constantly funneled to the rich, you're going to have competition, dog eat dog. Isn't that a great phrase? A dog eat dog culture where everybody is going to try to get ahead. And it makes perfect sense because, okay, here's a great example. I can give every penny I have to a homeless person and that's all fine, but how am I going to pay the rent next month? This only works if everybody in your society is doing it. If everybody in your society is passing wealth around, what you're building is social capital as opposed to building money capital. And so the way this would work is, I never know how to pronounce this name, the XHOSA of South Africa. They, if somebody went and killed an animal and then they did not share the meat with everyone, everyone else would laugh at them like a hyena, would make hyena sounds at them and basically say, you're a jerk. And some of the nations of the Pacific Northwest in the United States or Canada would have what they called a shaming poll, which is a poll that basically says, I'm a jerk. And if you were to go catch, you know, a bunch of fish and keep them for yourself, they would put this shaming poll there. Because you don't do that. What you do is when you catch something, you share it with everybody else. And the reason, okay, so I go fishing down at the creek here and I catch a bunch of fish and I give some to you. And the reason I can do this as opposed to selling them and accumulating is because I know tomorrow you are going to go huckleberry picking and you're going to distribute the huckleberries. So we can do this only because I know that all the food I give away today, you're going to give me food back tomorrow. But if it only works such that if every day if I get the fish and I give them to you, and then tomorrow you get the huckleberries and you keep them for yourself, society's going to fall apart. So that's when we come back to John Livingston, because my concern then is that if you get a really nasty culture that instead of, okay, we're going to go a different direction. And one of the first written myths of Western civilization is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq. Prior to Gilgamesh and prior to that time, Iraq was a cedar forest so thick the sunlight never touched the ground. And the first written myth of this culture is him cutting down those trees to make a great city. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. And the Near East was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. And the forests of North Africa were cut down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. And my point is that if you have a people who cut down the trees and use those to make machines of war, they will have a competitive advantage over their neighbors who don't. Because if you make machines of war and your neighbors don't, you can conquer them more easily. Are you with me? So this is why, for me, ideology ends up being not reliable, is because if you get one nasty culture, it's like it can infect all the other cultures by, okay, so the four of us, including the engineer, let's include him. So the four of us are having a little community and we all get along and we all share and everything's all fine. But then one of us decides to be an ass and one of us is no longer going to share. I'm sure you have been in enough social situations to know how that can affect our entire dynamic. And that's really what we're seeing on a global scale, is that you've got a few bad seeds. Now, bad seeds implies that they were that way from the beginning. You have a few cultures who have developed in hostile and abusive and sociopathic directions, and then they have metastasized across the globe through various means and by conquest. There's a great line by, what's his name? I can't remember the guy's name. Huntington, something like Huntington. Samuel Huntington, I think. He said, the West conquered the world not through the power of its ideas, but by its use of organized violence. And people in the West often forget this. People in what we would call the global South, people, you know, the people in the colonies never forget this. And so we think that we conquered the world. We, the Westerners, the white people, the civilized, whatever you want to call us, we think we conquered the world because our ideas are so smart and they spread around the world. No, we conquered because we conquered everybody. And we did it through organized violence.
This brings us to one of the major issues of the world and in humanity. Tend to be more aggressive. And when you're more aggressive, you actually end up having more.
Can you back up, please? Because you froze for a second. Can you start this question over, please?
So this brings us to a fundamental problem, and that is that the selfish, the so-called more dark forces of humanity, are organized and they're aggressive. When you have someone who's aggressive, they will have a greater effect on the whole group than those generally that are magnanimous and humanitarian. This is where deep green resistance is different. I'm sure you know about Andrew Harvey, who talks about
sacred activism.
And he argues that those that are of the light, if you want to say, that those that are humanitarian and want good for the planet have to, in order to win, have to become as organized and as not aggressive, but as active and strategic as the more aggressive, selfish forces. Otherwise, those that are selfish will win.
And of course,
because most people that are loving and humanitarian do not have a clear-cut strategy of having an effect on the world. By its nature, often love can be somewhat more open and passive. And this is where deep green resistance is different.
And in saying that, Andrew Harvey was one of the, I found that Andrew was one of the most loving. I was just blown away by his interview with us and what he had to say.
But so. he fiercely believes in activism and organization.
Completely agree. And also the other side is insatiable and they know what they want. And what they want is they want every last tree and they want it now. They want everything. And they don't rest. I can't tell you how many environmental activists have told me stories about how, and this has happened to me in my own activism, that we stop somebody from destroying a part of a forest and then they come back. And we stop them again and they come back. And we stop them again and we stop them again and they come back. And then one time, you know, you're sick. Or you have to take care of a sick relative or something's going on and you can't stop them and they cut down the forest. And this is the story of environmentalism. That's part of the story. And also one of the things I've said for a long time is that one of the reasons that we keep losing is because I don't think a lot of us know what we want. Do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, gentler clear cuts? We have not before you can have, okay, so I'm reading a book right now called Thunder on the Dnieper, and it's about the Russian defense against the German invasion in 1941, okay? And it's Zhukov was field marshal, developed a specific defense, blah, but we don't really care what it is. But I'm reading that book right now, and there was a line early on in it that really struck me, which is they were saying that one of the oldest maxims of military strategy is to not do what your enemy expects. And I thought about that line a lot. I don't think that that's quite the point. I think the point really is that you want to do what your enemy most fears. That's one of the ways you win, is figure out what your enemy would most fear, what you would fear if you were them, and then do it. Okay, my point is that I posted this question on Facebook, and most of the people, I was said, so what do you think those in power are really afraid of? And a lot of people were saying things like gardens, or making an alternative currency, or having an eco-commune. And I have to tell you, if I was in power, that would not scare me at all. Mm-hmm. And my point really here, and we're going to come back to this in a second, is there was one guy posted, what I would fear if I were them is somebody destroying my transportation capacity that allowed me to move resources. So I looked this guy up, and he's ex-military. It's like, of course he is. And that's where we get to DGR, is where we really start. We need to start thinking like members of a serious resistance. That doesn't mean you need to shoot people. It doesn't mean you need to blow things up. But it means we need to start asking, what do we want? And how do we make a strategy to get there? How do we get from point A to point B? How do we not merely try? It's incredibly important. Prairie dog village, that bunch of alligators, this river, that's really important to do. And I'm not saying anything bad against anybody who is protecting individual places or beings. But here's a question that is central to my book Endgame, that the reason I wrote that book is because I asked the question, do you believe the culture will have a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And I asked that question of literally tens of thousands of people over 10 years at talks. I would ask the audience, do you believe this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever said yes. Oh, one time, one guy put his hand up, he looked around and he said, oh, voluntary? No, of course not. And the point is that we will someday be living sane and sustainably, or we won't be living at all, by definition. But is that going to happen voluntarily? No. Nobody thinks yes. The next question is, if you don't believe the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and if you care about life on the planet, what does this mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is, we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we're all so busy pretending we have hope that there's going to be some magical transformation. And that is ridiculous. If you are playing a game of Monopoly or Risk, that is ridiculous. If you're playing a game of checkers, you don't simply hope for the best solution. What you do is you strategize. You think, what can we do to win? See, there's a problem too, is so many people, when I say, well, we need to fight to win, people object to me saying the word win. But when the world's already being killed, yes, I want to win. And winning for me is defined as, I want for there to be more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want for there to be more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want for there to be less dioxin in every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. Right now, humans are putting out as much plastic every year as the entire rate of human beings. And I want for there to be less plastic in the world every year than the year before. And how do we get there? I don't actually care how we get there. I just want us to get there. And so, first off, let's make some goals. What is victory? For me, victory is more wild salmon, less dead zones, et cetera, et cetera. We can talk about that. And the next question is, how do you get there? And industrial civilization is grinding away at the planet, and it's going to continue to grind away functionally. You can't have groovy solar panels without having the mining that goes with them. And mining is always destructive. So here's the deal, you know, it's not, I've been interviewed by people before who three questions in just start laughing because they say, my God, I thought, because you talk about how we need to bring down civilization before it kills the planet, I thought you were going to be pounding on the table and spitting, but you're actually kind of a nice guy. And the truth is, I am personally about it. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, I keep going like this. I don't even like killing mosquitoes. There's mosquitoes flying around my head, and I'm not going to smash them unless I have to. Sure. And I'm personally very nonviolent. And the reason I advocate for bringing down civilization is because I can do simple math. And I knew that there used to be 6 billion passenger pigeons in North America, and they're gone. Mm-hmm. I know that the salmon in the Klamath River, about 20 miles south of here, the Klamath is the second biggest river that runs into the Pacific from the United States after the Columbia. And it used to be that in this big river, that the fish were so thick that the entire river was black and roiling with them. And the Klamath Indians this year were not able to have their salmon ceremony because there aren't enough salmon. And so I can do
it's some- happening on a huge, huge scale. They're talking about a mass extinction. I saw the other day a photograph on Facebook of a man in Mongolia, which is very remote, who could not stand the stench of the river. He was actually covering his nose with his hand. This is in Mongolia. It's what's happening is phenomenal. But people, it's not just that people don't realize it. I think most people are concerned about what's happening on the planet. I don't know whether it's just the fact that we are not active enough. The other major problem is this, and Derek, maybe you've got some answers to this. I would like to, for example, become more involved with this. However, I've got to keep working in order to sustain my family. You know, and working creates, you know, you work all the time just to make ends meet.
As people do know, we've had Bruce Lipton on our show stating, you know, we're facing the sixth mass extinction of the planet, and other people have said this as well, and we're well aware of what's going on in the world with the global issues.
I guess what I'm saying, it's not just perhaps the fact that we're not motivated enough. That certainly needs to change, but it's also the fact that in order to sustain life, we have to keep working.
And we feel disempowered by our circumstances.
And okay, I completely agree. And there's a few places I want to go with this. One of them is that okay, there's three directions I want to go. One of them is that so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what that means on its most basic level to me is that for me, the big distinction in my life, the big thing that separates me from most mainstream environmentalists is that my loyalty is absolutely to the natural world. So here's an example. I do this program called Resistance Radio where I interview people. And I interviewed somebody about the Colorado River no longer reaching the ocean, which is true of 25% of rivers on the planet, by the way, and because the water's all sucked out. And at one point during the interview, he said, you know, the Colorado River really needs the water, but so does agriculture. And the truth is, I don't care about agriculture. I don't care that agriculture needs the water. My loyalty is 100% to the natural world at every moment. And so for me, that's the thing. Like I've had an email discussion with Bill McKibben, very friendly, about how he has done tremendous work to raise awareness about global warming. But my concern about him is that he keeps saying that we need to stop global warming because it'll bring down civilization. I don't care. What I care about is we need to stop civilization because it is killing the world. Mm. And my loyalty is to the world. And I have Crohn's disease and I require high-tech medicines to survive. I will die in 2 or 3 months without them. I don't care. I am not as important as the real world. As long as they're here, it won't do any good for me not to take them. But if I could stop the system that makes them at the cost of my own life, not even thinking.
Well, you know, I have something to say about that. Okay. I'm a doctor, but I've actually got some serious doubts about the way in which we practice medicine and big pharma and everything. Now, I've developed arthritis over the past 6 months, and I've been thinking, should I take these medications or not? So look at the side effects of the medications, and they're not very good. Having said that, as someone who practices mental health, a lot of the medications there do help people very much. So I think there is a role for medications. However, I have started deep green resistance on the inside over the past 48 hours. I'm literally resonating deep green. I have read, you know, I'm trying to use anti-inflammatory approaches to diet, and I have been drinking these very deep green drinks, which are full of spinach and kale and cucumbers and all these one chlorophyll. My arthritis is going. That's just amazing. This is without going on medication. So I guess that, you know, poses the question, do we actually need civilization to be healthy? Because I know I've read that so many of our diseases are due to civilization and the processed foods that we have.
The toxins and pollution and so many things.
Right. Yes. And those are really important points. And I mean, the Crohn's disease that I have, one of the beliefs for where it comes from is that we have too much hygiene, actually. There is, as countries industrialize, the Crohn's disease rate goes up. And they were wondering why, if it's diet, whatever. What they've really, the most recent theory is that we evolved with intestinal parasites. And one of the things that helminths, whipworms, do is they turn down your immune system so your immune system won't kill the whipworm. And autoimmune disorders are people's immune systems attacking themselves. And I actually take whipworms. I ingest them.
Really?
Okay.
I do high-tech medicines too. And once again, high-tech medicines, I would have been dead 12 years ago without high-tech medicines. But leave that aside for a moment. That what they've found is that the whipworms will, that's one of their jobs in the world, is to modulate your immune system.
Fascinating.
So they found that they help autoimmune disorders. Okay, I want to go back to the point that I was making. It's going to go three directions. One of them is that make you loyal to the real world absolute. And that changes everything as soon as you do that. The next thing is, one of the ways I think about this all the time is, you know, we recognize, and many people recognize how bad things are, but part of the problem is we still identify with the system and we care about the system. We've been taught, this is one of the things that happens with any abusive system, is you're taught to identify with the abuser. And that happens because if the abuser gets mad, they could beat you up or they could kill you. So you have to learn to care more about their feelings than your own. And this happens on a larger scale too. And one of the ways that I think about this whole culture that helps me break that identification, is to think, if space aliens came down and they were systematically deforesting the planet and they were putting plastics in all the oceans and they were putting docks in every mother's breast milk and they're changing the climate, we would know what to do. We would establish a very strong resistance and we would go after their infrastructure. We would stop them. But the problem is, and this is far more than the physical problem, the emotional problem is that we have identified with them so much that that we get all confused as to what we need to do, and we try to protect the system instead of real life. And here's just a really simple, silly example of this, that a friend of mine called me up and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Afghanistan? And I looked around and I said, we're in Afghanistan? I thought we're in Northern California. My friend's like, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Afghanistan? And I said, I got troops? Holy crap, will I do what I tell them? Oh, my mom, it's just right inside and upstairs. I'm at my mom's house. And it's pretty funny. a couple years ago, I was watching some television with my mom, and she, it was on the news about how the United States tortures. And my mom was going, oh, this is just so terrible that we torture. I looked at my mom and I said, oh my God, Mom, you torture? This is terrible. And she said, I'm in my 80s. I'm your mother. Don't do this to me. But my point is that we often talk about our system, our president, our leaders. It's not our system. It's their system. It's not our leader. It's their leader. And a great example of this is George Monbiot, who often does really good work. He was talking about how one of the reasons that you need nuclear power, I believe it was, is because how else are we going to get the energy that we need to run our brick factories? Okay, let's change a couple words. How else are the capitalists going to get the energy they need to run their brick factories? Now, having said that, that doesn't mean, I mean, you are forced by the system to get a job. And you are forced by the system to participate in the system. Don't feel bad because you do that. It's like they killed the salmon in the river, and now I'm supposed to feel bad because I have to get money to go to the grocery store to get food? That's crap. We are forced by the capitalists, in fact, and by this has been from the beginning. There's a great line by John Mohawk, the Indian. He says, there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty. And what he means by that is if they can control your food supply, they control you. And there's a great note from a Southern American pro-slavery philosopher writing to his Northern abolitionist buddy saying that we would get rid of slavery here in the American South, the 1830s. We would get rid of slavery here in the American South if we could change one thing. And that's the land ownership conditions. Because if you have a lot of land and not many people, then people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means the only way you can get them to go to work for you is at the point of a gun. If, on the other hand, you have a lot of people and not much land, they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter because they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they have to go to work for you. So my point is, if you are in a system that forces you to get a car, that forces you to get a job, don't feel bad. Instead, just do it and then also oppose that system with everything that you are.
So how do we do that, Derek? Are you suggesting that we all become self-sufficient with our food supplies?
No. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is we destroy the system.
I believe in compassionate use of force and protective use of force, and I'd love to talk to you about those things. I know we don't have a lot of time today, but...
I mean, if we can't do it today, we'll do it another time. And I want to get back to the activism thing that was really was a sort of genesis of this question. That I understand that people are busy, and I understand that I have the luxury of not ever having had children, for example. So I didn't have to raise them. I mean, that is a tremendous luxury in terms of giving me the time to write my books. I am okay. That said, the big distinction is not between those who think we need to bring down the whole system and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And here's how I got started as an activist. This is the smartest thing I ever did, and anybody can do this. When I was about 25, 26, I recognized that everything's really messed up, but I thought the problems are so big, I can't solve them. And so I didn't do anything, which a lot of people do. That's a big excuse. It's like, oh, it's the sixth mass extinction. What am I going to do? I can't do anything. So they sit around. I have no patience for that. But that's how I was when I was 25. And then I had this idea one day that I wasn't paying enough for gas. At the time, gas was, say, a buck a gallon. And I realized it didn't cover the ecological or social costs. So instead of just feeling guilty for using gas, by the way, I want to back up a second. And about 20 years ago, I was talking to an American Indian friend of mine, and I said, gosh, I feel so terrible because I cause global warming, because I drive a car, and it's all my fault. And she got very stern with me and said, look, you didn't create culture. It's not your fault. Don't take responsibility for what's not yours. Instead, destroy culture. That's where the action is not just individual action. But when I want to think of gas, so I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas, and I also wasn't doing anything. So what I decided to do is for every dollar I spent on gasoline, I would give a dollar to a local environmental organization. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have any money. So instead, I paid myself $5 an hour to do activism. So if I filled my tank, which at the time cost 10 bucks, that means I am committed to doing 2 hours of activism, which anybody can do. You know, it's like if I say, how am I going to stop this whole system? I can't do anything. But if I do one little thing, if I can do 2 hours this week, I started by writing letters to the editor. And then after that, I did anti-fur demos and I did anti-circus demos. You know, I didn't know anything about circuses except they're just nasty. And I didn't let that. I love this line by Florence Nightingale. I attribute my success to the fact that I never gave nor took an excuse. And mm-hmm. I did not let my ignorance stop. I just knew circuses are bad. I didn't know why, but I still showed up anyway. Just show up. And they gave me a sign. I literally was standing there with a sign. Some guy walks by and says, why are circuses so terrible? And I said, I don't know. I just know they're bad. Ask this guy here. And I mean, it got me started. And the point is, once you start, then you start having so much fun and it feels so good to do it. I'm saying this to all the listeners. It feels so good to do it and it feels, it's fun. So then you'll start more and more. And that's how you, anybody, I don't care if you are a single mother or father, a single mother of two children working a job, working two jobs, you still have 1 hour a week you can do something. Mm. Anybody can peel off 1 hour.
It's a fantastic idea to pay yourself to be an activist. It's wonderful. Having said that, if the system is destroyed, we need to put in place another system. And I'm presuming that you would advocate replacing civilization with a more tribal, sustainable form of living, and that we need to start practicing this now, because if we destroy the system, we need to have something sustainable to take its place.
Because a lot of this is coming from feelings of deprivation and the victim mentality. I mean, that's at the core of, and so that needs to be filled. I think that's a lot of what you were saying earlier, Derek.
Well, completely agree. And military people will tell you, what was it, Napoleon said that an army marches on its belly? And Rommel said that the quartermaster is the one who wins battles by making sure you've got gasoline for your tanks. And Kropotkin, I don't know why I'm throwing out all these other people, but Kropotkin, the anarchist philosopher, talked about all these revolutions that failed because of bread. I completely agree. And this is where, you know, it's my relationship with permaculturalists is really interesting, because there are some permaculturalists, especially, how do I say this? Especially young devotees who get really excited about permaculture, and they get really pissed at me because I talk about organized resistance and they think that I'm dissing permaculture. But the point is, permaculture by itself doesn't do a damn thing. And the big permaculturalists understand that, but it has to be part. If you are doing permaculture to feed the revolution, that is where it's at. And a lot of the big permaculturalists really agree with this, that it can't be by itself. Making an alternative community doesn't do a thing to stop those in power. But at the same time, if you're doing activism, someone needs to feed you. And that's where permaculture comes in. And it's absolutely crucial. Yes, there have to be. We have to create those alternative food systems at the same time that we destroy the big ag completely.
It's got to be a multi-level approach.
I'm wondering if, do you know, one of the first books I read, I really wanted to ask you this. Are you familiar with Daniel Quinn and Ishmael?
Yes, and I have to tell you, the only reason I never cite Daniel Quinn is because I didn't read him until after I was already writing. Had I read his work before I figured these things out on my own, he would, I mean, I like his work. He's great. I'm not complaining about him. What I'm saying is I read him too late to influence me. Does that make sense? But yeah, Daniel Quinn is all great stuff. I don't agree. By the way, when he says you can just walk away, and Lewis Mumford says this too, I don't agree with either of them. You can't just walk away when the system is killing the planet. So that's a place I disagree with both him and Mumford.
So we're going to have to finish up very soon. I'm just wondering whether you can give people your website and suggest what people can do.
Yes. And how long do we have?
We have to finish like now.
Do we have 1 minute?
About 1 minute.
Okay, DerrickJensen.org, DerrickJensen.org. And so far as what they can do, that's where we have amount of time, I would more talk about it. What they can do is find what you love. Find, no matter what it is, it's under assault. So if you love frogs, defend frogs and just start and don't let your ignorance stop you. Just start. If what you love is women, stop men's violence against women. If what you love is discourse, fight for discourse. No matter what it is, it's under assault. Just get off your butt and do something.
I'd just like to finish off with a beautiful paragraph that you read, that you wrote. So that while deep green resistance is about fighting back, in the end, this organization is about love. The songbirds and the salmon need your heart, no matter how weary, because even a broken heart is still made of love. They need your heart because they are disappearing, slipping into that longest night of extinction, and the resistance is nowhere in sight. We will have to build that resistance from whatever comes to hand. It will be hard, there will be a cost. It may seem impossible, but in the end, we have to do it anyway. So gather your heart and join with every living being. With love as our first cause, how can we fail?
That's fantastic.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. So look, thank you so much for talking with
thank
us.
You. Thank you for
we
being on the show.
We would love to have you back on our show some other time. There are so many things to talk about.
I definitely have a lot that I'd love to talk about. But
thank you very much, Derrick.
Let's set it up. I would look forward to that. Thank
All
you
right.
so
much.
That'd Lovely. Be great. Thank you, Derrick.
So this is Universal Soul Love signing off. Dr. Lana Love.
And Detective David Love. Thank you for being on our show and listening in.
And everyone, have a wonderful, deep, green week.
Bye for now.
Lots of love. Bye.
Bye.